You are hearing voices from NPR, the best of public radio. This is part one of a tribute to radio raconteur Gene Shepard, produced for KCRW in the year 2000 by another radio and TV great.
I'm Harry Shearer. Late in 1999, Gene Shepard died. The obituaries made reference mainly to his series of programs for PBS, Gene Shepard's America, and to his work on the movie that's now become a perennial holiday classic, A Christmas Story. Passing mention was made of the two decades of broadcasts he did, nightly broadcasts, some of them marathons, on New York's WOR-AM, a radio station with a signal that roamed the East Coast at night like a restless salesman. Radio's such an ephemeral medium. Stuff on it seems to be there forever until suddenly it's gone. Memories about Gene Shepard's remarkable body of work on WOR are beginning to fade, so that's why there's this broadcast. In the next couple of hours, you'll hear some people who talk about how Gene Shepard's radio work influenced their lives and their work. You'll hear some people talk about how Shepard approached the task of storytelling and satirizing the world he saw around him. But what drives me crazy about a lot of these programs is that the thing itself is heard only in snippets. So, most importantly, you'll hear on this broadcast great generous helpings of Gene Shepard on the radio, so you can enjoy and judge for yourself the impact of Gene Shepard, A Voice in the Night.
We're a little late, folks. Thanks for listening. God bless you, and good night.
In the late 1950s, the radio in the American house was an appliance that had been given its notice. The job of providing large-scale dramatic and comedy entertainment, performed on large stages in front of studio audiences, that job had been given to the new box in the living room, television. Radio had to reinvent itself or die. It was as if the waffle iron were told, learn to make coffee or move on. So new formats were being tried. All news, top 40, talk, telephone talk. There was even a brief fling in Los Angeles with all classified ads radio. At virtually the same time in Hollywood, Stan Freberg, a satirist who'd already had some hit records making fun of other hit records, got the last big-time network radio comedy show, complete with big band and big audience. While in New York, Gene Shepard was among those, also including comedy team Bob and Ray, who were inventing a much more intimate kind of radio. Just a guy or two in a studio, maybe an engineer behind the glass. That's it. Shepard's career began on WOR, a legendary New York radio station, with an all-night show.
Wouldn't it be fascinating if we had preserved, actually preserved, really preserved, just the way he was, you see, with his armor on and everything, a Roman gladiator. If somehow he was preserved in ice or something, we had him now, wouldn't he be a great attraction? Well, let me tell you this, that you will be just as great an attraction 2,000 years from now. If we could preserve you, any one of you, even the nothingest of us, me, any of us, you know, we'd be fascinating to a guy who thought, here's a real 20th century man, just the way he was, sitting there with that funny look on his face, kind of sad, obviously suffering from post-Ed Sullivan shock, just sitting there with a limp old copy of TV Guide in his hand, one shoelace open. I mean, you know how like we really are, you know? With a hole in the sock, the whole business, sitting there, you'd be a real specimen. And here is your chance to achieve immortality. I was contacted tonight by a group of scientists who do not wish to be identified. They would like to have three specimens from among the audience who would willing to volunteer to be preserved. Sealed in plastic, you know, plastisealed? So for all time, you would be you. And after 1,000 years, you'd be great. Really, you'd be famous. You'd be in a museum in a case. And after 2,000 years, you'd be bigger than the Rosetta Stone. And you're nothing now, you know that.
This is Paul Krasner. I'm the editor of The Realist. I was a friend of Gene Shepard, but before I was a friend, I was a fan. And I published several of his radio dissertations in edited form in The Realist. But when I was a fan, my idea of a hot date would be to find a girl who also liked Shepard and lie in bed with her all night listening to Shepard. He was on Monday through Friday from midnight to 5:30 a.m., and it ruined my school. I had him on all night, and I would fall asleep. I would wake up at 3 a.m., and he would be talking about how to explain to a Venusian what an amusement park was for. Or he would talk about somebody he knew who could taste an ice cube and know what the make of the refrigerator it came from was and what year that was built. He would tell us stories with jazz in the background that introduced me to jazz. I remember hearing for the first time him play Bessie Smith singing Empty Bed Blues. One time he had a milling. He just invited listeners to come to this empty parking lot and at a certain time and just mill around. I went there, and there were a bunch of people just milling around. The cops came, and nobody would tell them what they were there for. Just a bunch of people milling around in an empty parking lot. It looked very suspicious. And finally, the cops found out, and they saw people walking along the street, and they would say to him, are you waiting for Shepard? It was the poor person's version of waiting for Godot. One of the things that Shepard did was he would hurl epithets. He would have people turn the volume on their radio down all the way and put the radio on the windowsill with the window open. And he would say, okay, whisper. He'd say, okay, now put the volume all the way up. And then he would scream something like, you filthy pragmatist, I'm going to get you. And you'd hear it echo all around from all the different apartments that had their radios on the windowsill. And I found somebody in my building who did it. And I met him, and it turned out to be a 17-year-old Nazi who liked it when Shepard talked about Nietzsche. So I guess the moral is that everybody listens or reads any artist totally subjectively.
Joe Frank, who has told a story or two on radio himself, remembers discovering Gene Shepard.
When I was a boy, I had difficulty going to sleep. I suffered from insomnia. I was fearful. And at a certain point, I began to listen to Gene Shepard, and there was something so comforting and exhilarating about listening to him. His stories of growing up in Indiana, his reading of poems of R.W. Service, his reciting of stories having to do with some, I believe it was an evil genius, Fu Manchu. Or maybe it was a good fellow, Fu Manchu, I don't remember. But what I do remember is that Gene Shepard had a positive, life-affirming, warm humanity that I didn't experience in my life. And it gave me a genuine sense of comfort and peace as I lay in bed at night listening to him, and made it possible for me to be able to go to sleep.
But the classic Gene Shepard shows were less than an hour in length, and they came on late every night. They started out with an almost manic theme evoking horse racing, maybe evoking the rat race going on in New York. Shepard would begin the shows with a touch of zaniness, maybe playing his kazoo or his nose flute, maybe reading a bizarre news story. There'd be a commercial or two, a sardonic swipe at station management more often than not, a mordant throwaway observation or two about modern life, and then he'd kind of back into the point of the program. A story.
At a certain age in life, when you're, I'd say roughly between 15 and 19, you really believe you know what it's about. You really seriously think you've got life by the you-know-what. And you really know what it's about. And you can't figure out why all these other people, usually older people, keep saying that things are not what they seem to be. What do you mean they're not? They are. You really believe it. And then of course, as you get older, you begin to have faint inklings of what an ignoramus you have been up to this point in life, And it's just beginning to dawn on you what an unbelievable, ignorant slob you are now. Now, I'm going to tell you one of those great... Each one of us have great moments of illumination. The moment of realization. We spend most of our lives trying to outlive our past in one way or another. If you're rich, you try to outlive being rich. And you quite often wind up pretending that you're a simple little peasant and you're a really true hippie living on nothing but, you know, beans a week. That's why most hippies come from wealthy or at least affluent families. They're trying to run away from their past. On the other hand, the really poor kids don't buy the hippie scene because that's where they've been all their life. I mean, they're trying to outrun theirs, see? And this causes a lot of confusion among hippies because they go out and they try to make it with the, you know, they try to make it with the real poor guys, and the poor guys think that's a joke. And it, just the same as if a rich guy walking around in his estate, some fancy place, you know, and he's got these beautifully clipped hedges and all that. When he finds that some, you know, real Bowery bum is trying to pretend he's rich, that's ridiculous too. And we can't really ever quite expunge our past. See? Well, my home when I was a kid, our idea of a really great meal was meatloaf. My mother was, a total meatloaf. That was her whole thing was based on meatloaf. Now, one meal we would have meatloaf and carrots with mashed potatoes. Then the next meal we would have meatloaf and peas and mashed potatoes. Then we would have meatloaf and red cabbage and mashed potatoes. And that's the way, it would vary. Then once in a while, my mother, when we'd have a big, like, big holiday, she would make meatloaf with tomato sauce on top of it. that was a big moment. Well, there were all kinds of foods that were just remote foods to us. And they were things you read about. And when you read about them, you'd go, who would eat that? Wow. I remember discussions that would occasionally pop up in our house. My mother would say, or my old man or something, say, do you know the people... They actually eat raw clams? Ugh. Of course, nobody in our family had ever tasted them or anything like this. See, but it was just the idea of this was to forget it. I'm sure that people who have grown up in a family where at the age of three they're eating, all the way from clams to caviar and the whole bit right from the time they're little. I imagine kids and grown-ups in that type of family will say to one another, do you realize that there are some people who actually eat something called meatloaf? Ugh. And so, you see, it's a real experience for them later on in life when they decide they're going to play, they're going to play poor, they're going to be hippie, to actually eat meatloaf. Real meatloaf. I mean, now, I don't know whether you've ever had that in Westport, friends, but that's the way it is. So, nevertheless, now I am beginning to slowly rise in the world. I have... struggled my way through the Warren G. Harding School, and I'm still in the meatloaf bag, right? But the one groovy thing about this world where you're constantly, I think this is one of the fascinating things of America. You know that a lot of people in other countries don't even think to argue about getting, I suppose you can call it, equal rights, because it's unthinkable in a lot of countries. By definition, that's why a lot of countries don't have any trouble. You keep thinking they don't have problems. They don't have, everybody's got rights. Oh, no. In many parts of the world, and in places you'd be quite surprised to know about, that people are born in a certain social strata, and that is where they are. It's like being born with web feet or something. You got it. That's the end of it, see? Well, here in America, it's very different. And the idea of, rising out of this meatloaf world is just sort of automatic. You try to do it. So anyway, the groovy thing about going to school in a lot of ways is hardly anybody knows where you came from. You're all in this place. I was going to college. And, of course, I was barely scraping on, man. It was tough. So I'm hanging around. I got this one suit and I got this one sport coat. And so I got to know a couple of chicks and people there around. I never talked much about things. And one night, this girl, very elegant girl with long blonde hair, asked me, she says, Would you care to come to dinner tonight at my home? Now, we're having a few people over, and I think it would be kind of fun. I said, yeah. You know, I'm always very glib with my ad-libs. Yeah. So she said, have you ever been out to the place? And I said, no, I haven't. And she gives me this address in this town where the school was. And I knew nothing whatsoever about it. So I said, okay, I'll be there. And she says, oh, don't bother to dress or anything like that. I said, oh, yeah, fine. I didn't realize the import of this at the time. Don't bother to dress. Yeah. I mean, don't bother to dress. So that night, I put on my J.C. Penney sport coat, and I put on my Sears Roebuck pants, and I've got on my new shirt, the one with the pearl buttons that light up, and I've got my tie that my Aunt Glenn gave me for graduation from high school. And so I go walking down, cooling out there towards this place. Well, as I walk, the houses got bigger and bigger, and the lawns got broader and broader. Until they were so big, the lawns, that you couldn't see the house anymore. And you knew you were really in the big time when the house was so far back on the lawn that you just saw nothing but trees and this winding driveway. Oh, boy. Well, I now join the gathering in this fantastic house. Oh, wow. They had white pillars in front of the door. Remember, they had this big brass knocker, and they just go bunk, bunk. And it was shaped like a lion. And you grab this thing and you drop it, and clunk, clunk, and this guy comes and opens the door. And I say, I'm invited to dinner. Oh, of course, come right in. And in I go. He says, shall I take your hat? Your hat, you know. Your coat, please? If he took my coat off, you know, nothing. So I says, no, that's all right. So I walk back in through. I followed him. And now I'm in this room, and these people were all standing around. There was about maybe 15, 20 people, and here was Nancy, this girl, and her sister, Dolores. But Nancy was something else, man. And so here's Nancy, and she says, oh, Gene, how wonderful you could come. And so she came running over, and she kissed me. See, this was not in my straight-up society. One doesn't do these things, you know. This whole idea of just running up and kissing somebody. Now, you know, we had to have a big thing like a game of post office or something to pull that one off. So she comes right over and she kisses me. Oh, how good of you to come. And she kisses me. I said, yeah, hi, Nancy. She says, here, would you care for a drink? James, please. And with that, James comes over with a big tray with the drinks. And there are these tall, skinny glasses, you know, the long, tall, skinny stems. So I had never really held one of those glasses, so I grabbed it and I tipped over instantly. And down it goes, all over the floor. She says, oh, I'm sorry. And with that, you know, everybody's brushing all this, running around. And so James says, excuse me, sir. So he brushes off the furniture where I spilled all the goo-goo all over it. So I take another one of these things, and I'm walking around. It's a martini, see? So I had never had a martini before. Our family, the only thing my old man used to talk about once in a while drinking, the only thing he ever talked about in the way of actual drink was, he used to say, how about some booze? We didn't ever have any actual names for it. It was just called booze. Once in a while, when he was really putting on the dog, as he would say it, he would have a thing called a highball. Now, a highball means that you put booze in a glass, and then you pour over ginger ale. That was what a highball was. So I've got this thing, martini. See, it tasted terrible to me. See, it tasted like I was, you know, like I drink some kind of strange chemical. It tastes like chemicals. Whew! Said, wow, had this little olive bobbing up and down there. Well, I liked the olive, so I reached in, I took the olive out, and I crunched it. It was the first olive I ever saw in my life that had an almond in it. So all new things were opening up already, saying that little olive. Yeah, that olive, it was stuffed with an almond. So I'm walking around with these people, and suddenly they all move like a herd of cattle. They say, oh, it's time for dinner, ho, ho, ho. We move into the next room. And we're all sitting down at this big, beautiful table, white tablecloth, and a crystal and linen and all that. And I sit down, and, food, I don't know, what's going to happen there? And then it came. Nancy, sitting next to me, she said, have you had any the fresh escargot this season yet? So what? I said, well, yes, yes, it's a good season. You know, I'm faking it all the way. And the next thing I know, in front of me is this plate of something which had always been rumored in our house that people somewhere, someplace, ate. And we never really believed it. And whenever it was mentioned that they ate these things, it was universal, oh, ugh, a plate of snails with the little forks. God, snails. Snails. Ooh. And instantly inside of me, you know, my meatloaf insides are immediately saying, oh, my God, this is all fantastic. And Nancy, she takes one of the snails. She says, oh, these are so wonderful. She takes one out, and I see how she does it. She takes this little fork, and she fishes one of these things out. And it comes out, and it looks strange. You know, it's like a little black snake or something. See, she pulls it out. She goes, oh, here was this beautiful girl. Well, what am I going to do? I can't chicken out. See? So I says, oh, they look very good. I take the little thing, and I'm feeling sick inside my little fork, and I fish it out. I put it in my mouth. I go, oh, my God. Oh, my God. It was fantastic. It was fantastic. I tasted this thing. It was so good, I couldn't believe it. Well, now, you know, then I went the other way. I made a total pig of myself. I went, I ate all the snails up so quick. I mean, they were gone. And then the lesson hit me. I looked around. I saw all these other people. They've been doing this all of their lives. They weren't surprised at snails. And then it began to sneak in on me. What other terrible stuff did I learn at home? What other things do I think are awful? Just because it was back in the kitchen that way, you know? I ate the snails. And late that night when I got home, I'm laying in the dormitory room, and I could feel them snails. You could taste them. You know, there's an aftertaste. And I begin to suspect that night there was a fantastic, unbelievable world out there, and I was just beginning to taste it. Just beginning. God knows where it would lead.
This Gene Shepherd tribute, hosted by Harry Shearer of Le Show, continues in a minute on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
You are hearing voices, and this is A Voice in the Night, produced and hosted by Harry Shearer, a tribute to Gene Shepherd.
I'm Kenneth Turan. I'm a film critic for the Los Angeles Times. I stumbled on Gene Shepherd literally as a kid in Brooklyn in high school, just turning the dials on the radio. I can remember we had this little table radio, little tiny plastic radio, and I used to turn the round dial selector, and this voice came on, you know, and when you heard this voice, it stopped you, because it was such a hypnotic voice, and it was unlike anything else on radio. He'd go out on these tangents, and he'd somehow bring you back. It was intoxicating. It was hypnotic.
And I think that he was really important in that respect, that for many people who lay in bed at night and were alone and felt cut off, he was like a bridge to hope of some kind, to hope of connection with other human beings. He created a world that I think most of us did not inhabit, but would have liked to have inhabited.
Shepherd not only told stories about his past, he also functioned as a reporter. Here he is at his live Saturday night gig at the Limelight Club in Greenwich Village, reporting on his tour of England with the Beatles.
The Beatles sat in total control of their world. They would either admit people or they would deny them. They would either give them an audience or they would turn them down. And believe it or not, it got to the point with me, you know. I'll tell you, there's a funny thing in human beings where I began to feel special myself because they talked to me. Yes. This is the kind of nuttiness that must have created a Hitler. Must have felt good to a guy, you know, to walk in and have Mr. Hitler say, oh, hello, hey, there goes Hans. Hi, Hans. How many of you would like to be greeted by first name by, say, Lucky Luciano? No, it's a secret thing. We all have a secret desire to somehow be greeted on a first name basis by somebody who is a real myth and a legend. And up to this point, you know, I had been a non-believer. And I saw this happening. Nobody got angry at the Beatles. Oh, no. When the Beatles would throw somebody out like the Countess, just hurl her out in the street, it was all she deserved. And she felt pleased to have spoken with them for a moment. And so it got to the point where I would come in and John would look up and say, how are you doing, Gene? I would glow. The Beatles recognized me, you know? And I realized that I had been admitted to Olympus. I was allowed to be on the same plane with a world phenomenon. Fascinating. I kept trying to say to myself later, I'd get out of the room. You know, I was over there on a special assignment to do a piece for a major magazine on the Beatles. And I would get out of the room, you know, and they've talked to me. We've sat and had drinks and stuff, and I would get out into the privacy of a hotel aisle or a hotel hallway, and I'm walking along, and all of a sudden I says, what are you doing? This is a rock and roll group. These are the Beatles. For God's sake, Shepard, get a grip on yourself. And then the door would open down there, and McCartney would stick his head out and he'd say, hey, Gene, when you come back, knock twice. We'll let you in. We don't want to let anyone else. Just let knock twice. He'd slam the door, and then I'd say, I know what I'm doing. God recognizes me. Well, you know, I learned something then. I learned how almost impossible it must be for a reporter to remain objective in the presence of the very great. Notoriety can be greatness, you know.
That was three decades before O.J.
This is Jules Feiffer, cartoonist and other things. Gene Shepard came into my life in the early 1950s. I was just out of the Army. I had just gotten my first apartment living alone, apart from my mother. Having broken her heart and hoping to meet some girls, I took this apartment. And finding myself terribly isolated, like so many other New Yorkers, I started listening as I sat on my drawing board to late-night radio, flipping around the stations, and stumbled, as apparently thousands did at the same time or close to the same time, on this soothing voice of Gene Shepard, who was remembering all of the things I remembered from my past, although his past was kind of a suburban or rural past. I mean, from Indiana, had nothing to do with the very urban, very poverty-stricken Bronx that I was raised in. And yet, it seemed to me to be everything that I knew and recognized.
Like a true satirist, unlike a politician, Shepard loved to tell his audience things that he knew they didn't want to hear. To an audience made up of hip folks, Greenwich Village types, and alienated youth all up and down the East Coast, Shepard told stories of life in the Army, someplace he knew most of us would never willingly find ourselves.
I was with a group of guys who were suddenly transferred out of the field that they had been in for a couple of years, radar. We were all veteran raiders. Some of the guys have been overseas for 3 years, and other guys have been overseas for 2 years, and they had ribbons and badges, and they were highly trained in all this highly technical equipment. When one day, one of those little mistakes that happen when people are operating mimeograph machines at Army headquarters, my little group was removed suddenly from its context, and they were sent to classification. And there were three PFCs sitting in front of us, and they were saying, well, what do you want to be in the Army now? Well, now, don't look at me and say, how could that happen? I'll tell you, it was the truth. They sent us to a place where new Army guys were being processed. And our little group had gotten detached. How it got detached is a long story and a boring one. But suddenly we found ourselves being classified as rookies. And so we're all sitting there, glaring. It's like taking a whole bunch of guys, like take, if you're your office now, you've been working, we'll say, at BBDO for 9 years. And all of a sudden you came there one morning and they had taken all the signs down. It didn't say BBDO anymore. And they're just there. You walk into your office and there were three guys sitting there at desks. And as you came in, they said, "Sit down, fella." I said, "What do you mean, fella? I'm vice president here in charge of the pickle account. What do you mean, vice? What do you mean? Sit down, fella, sit down. All right, now you're all here. We'd like to ask you all now, what would you like to do in life? What kind of job would you like to have? And we're going to give you some forms, some questionnaires here. We're going to give you a few little tests, and we'll decide what you guys can do. Some of you might become ditch diggers. Some of you might go out and work in the pencil factory. Maybe a few of you might find yourself working down at the street department. But in any event, let's find out what you're... You'd be shocked. What? Well, here we are. There's about 38 of us. And we are sitting in this insane moment, and we couldn't believe it. We thought, this, it just can't happen. This is not happening at all. Guys kept looking around at each other. Well, what are we going to do? What are we doing? And these smug PFCs who were up there and had been classifying rookies for years, you know, they sat there and they had the sharp creases in their shirts. And they were cadre, you know, and they just got the forms. All right, now, we're going to begin alphabetically. Adams, is there Adams here? Adams, Corporal Adams here? All right, we're going to start with you, Corporal Adams. You go over there and sit with PFC Anderson. Anderson will sit down there and talk to you, and then blah, 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 all the way on. And we'll decide what you're going to do in the Army. And all the while, the radio's playing. And coming out of the radio was an announcement. And it was a New York radio station. I don't know whether, you know, the average announcer who's doing a public service announcement never thinks anybody's really actually listening to this. You know, it's just the sound he's making. And here was this announcer saying, "Yes, friends, if you have any special training in electronics, if you have any special training, if you're an amateur radio operator, if you have any training in radio, the armed forces need you in the new secret work going forward in radar. Yes, there is a desperate need for radar technicians. Sign up right now. Radar technicians are needed right this very minute." And here we are, 38 radar technicians all sitting there, and we're in the middle of the classification center, and they're trying to decide what we're going to do. Well, Gasser, who's sitting up in the front, says, Hey, fella, listen to what the guy's saying, hear that? Why don't I just go down and quit and go back out and re-enlist, huh? I'll re-enlist, and I'll become one of these, what are they, radar guys? Gasser had at least 15 MOSs. That meant he had about... what is the Army equivalent of degrees of training after his name in the field of radar. I had about 9.5. And so here's this announcer, and he is saying, "Yes, if you would like to enlist in that fascinating new field called radar, if you have any training in radio, please get in touch immediately. Your country needs you. The need is dire. Right now, we need And here we are. And this guy's up there deciding whether or not we're going to be latrine orderlies. There's a big school that we're opening up to teach guys how to type on the L.C. Smith typewriter. There's a whole bunch of things opening up that you never know what exciting things might be opening up for you. We've got a wire school here where they teach you how to solder wires together. Whew. And so we were, you know, and you're trapped. It's like Kafka. We knew that we weren't going to get out. That's it. Here we were. We were here to be classified. They were going to send us to school after we'd been in the Army a minimum of 2 years apiece. And so finally, Gasser or somebody says to the guy, "All right, excuse me, Corporal, what's the longest course?" And the guy says, "What's the longest course? What's that got to do with it?" He says, "Well, if this insanity is going to go on, I might as well take the longest course. You got one that lasts 4 years? I can stay here in New York anyway. I don't care what it is, plumbing, I don't care. What do you want?" He looked at him, he says, "All right, smart guy. We're going to decide what you're ready for, what you can take." Well, all 38 of us were assigned to the code school at Fort Monmouth. Well, I have to explain that there were two types of code schools. There's what they call the high-speed operator, which is used for transatlantic high-speed operation, and there's what they call the low-grade field operator. Well, friends, the low-grade field operator is the guy you see in the shell hole with all the rocks coming down on him, you know, and the dirt and stuff is falling down on him and all the shrapnels, and he's got a little key, and he is sending in code. He's sending the SOS when the battalion is cut off and they don't want to use voice transmission. Well, that had a particular kind of connotation to us, and here we were. It wasn't that we were afraid of this. It was as though we were being taken. It's like taking a group of nuclear scientists and training them to be file clerks. Literally. Oh, are we bugged? Oh, mad. And so we sat in our little cubicles. Now, the code school at Fort Monmouth has to be seen to be believed. It's unbelievable. Now, for those of you who don't know what code is, I will blow a little code for you. A lot of chirp on that note. That is a CQ. I will send WOR for you. That's WOR. I will send my name for you. SHEP. Now, have you often wondered what they send in the newsreels? When you hear the code going, well, I'll tell you what they send. They send this. Which is news. They said news, news, news over and over again. That's what the code says. Well, there I am. I'm a code man, and I can send and receive code a minimum at that point of probably 45 words a minute. I was really at my apex. I had a 45-word-a-minute ARRL certificate, and at least 75% of the 38 men I was with were guys who could send and receive faster than any of the people they had at the code school who were teaching it. But the one thing we did not want to let them know was that we could do it. We did not want it. And so we went back to the barracks, and we're sitting there glumly. We're going to go to code school tomorrow, see? And so finally, I think it was Ripper, or maybe it was Goldworm. I don't remember who it was. One of them says, "Ain't going to get no code out of me." He had said it for all of us. Because, you know, it's funny, there's always one guy in a crowd that's the catalyst. One guy in the crowd causes the crowd to go down and burn down the city hall. Now, the rest of them may want to do it, but it takes that catalyst, that one guy that says, "Let's go down now, I'm going." Then the whole crowd goes. Now, they may want, that catalyst is important. And so whoever that guy was, Goldworm or Weber, one of them, he said, "Ain't going to get no code out of me." Well, the next morning, after we had all tacitly agreed that we're going to be no code learned in this crowd, we arrived at the code school. Now, the code school is three stories high. It is fantastic. It covers like a full block down. You never saw anything like it. And there are thousands of guys all sitting there with earphones and each with a little cubbyhole, these cubbyhole-type desks. Some of the guys that are already up in the high-speed operation now are working with typewriters. And all the way on up, the various speed levels go until way down at the ground floor, the guys are learning the alphabet, like A, da, B, da, da, C, da 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 da, D, da da da, and way up at the top floor, the finished product was sitting there typing away. The high-speed operator, he's knocking it off at 55 words a minute. Well, here is our little band of 38 guys down on the ground floor, and they gave us our designation. We were class D2. You see, each little detachment is given a number, like D1, D2, D3, D4, or maybe it's C1, C2, C3, C4. And as you go through the entire thing, you keep together as a unit, providing you all learn code at roughly the same speed. And as you pass each test, you move on to the next table and the next table. And they have this gigantic thermometer that shows how all the groups are progressing. C, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all the various little groups. And there was D2 right there. It had this little red dot down at the bottom of the big thermometer. And we all started the same day. And I remember the introductory remarks by the instructor. He's on the PA system, and it's all coming through in our cans. We're all sitting there looking official. "Men, you're about to learn code CW, continuous wave transmission. This is one of the most honored methods of man in our day and time to communicate. Ships have communicated this way now since the early 1900s. You are beginning to learn some of the romance of radio communication. And now, good luck, men, and let's see which detachment gets to the top first. You will begin with the basic alphabet. And now, let's go to work. Boop, boop. Boop, 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 boop. You have just heard the first two letters of the alphabet, A and B. We will repeat them. A, boop, boop. B, boop, 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 boop. We now move to C. Boop, 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 boop. And now D. Boop, boop, boop. Now see if you can identify the four letters we are about to send. Boop, 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 boop. Boop, boop. Boop, 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 boop. Boop, boop, boop. As you identify them, write them down on the pad in front of you. You will find a pencil to your right. Boop, boop. A. Well, we sat there. And remember, all of us are high-speed operators, guys who had built their own transmitters, guys who would use bugs. The whole scene, we're sitting there. That's like 15 famous surgeons all sitting down and somebody saying, you are now going to learn how to use a Band-Aid. The Band-Aid is a basic type of bandage. The bottle at your right is called Mercurochrome. It is used... We're sitting there, see? Well, the first day passed, and I don't think one of us wrote down one single letter. We kept writing. They would go, boop, 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 boop. I'd scratch my head. That's D. D. And all the while, the corporal, who was in charge of our section, kept walking back and forth looking at us. He said, no. Now, listen carefully. At first, you see, he thought we were really playing the game. He'd say, now, listen carefully, fella. Now, look. Now, here. All of you fellas, at ease, all of you. Now, turn off your earphones. Now, fellas, you must listen. Don't listen for dots and dashes, fellas. Listen for dits and da's. Dit, da. Dit, da. It is not dot, dash. It is dit, da. So A goes dit, da. B goes da, dit, dit, dit. It does not go dash, dot, dot, dot. Now, I think that's maybe where the confusion is falling. Some of you guys aren't listening to it right now. Okay? All right, let's start again now. All right, all set now. We'll start at the beginning. Dit, da. And 38 guys are scratching. Some guys are writing down E. Other guys are writing down B. And he's walking around. He's going, what is it? Oh, now, fellas, now wait a minute. Now, look, maybe you're nervous. You're nervous. Let's take a five-minute break. Five-minute break. I'll go out for smoke. You're nervous. Just relax. Look up at the clouds. Take it easy. Now, five-minute break. Okay, fellas, be back in 5 minutes. 5 minutes later, we're back, and it goes, boop, 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 boop. Oh, that's an A. Yes, I got it. Finally, it's coming. It's an A. Well, the next day, all the other groups that were in our same, that all started together with us, about nine groups started together, all of them had a little red mark beginning to appear on the thermometer. They had risen up past the four-word-per-minute thing, you know, up to 5 words. They were already taking, and they were moving on to the next tables. Our little band of malcontents were still having trouble with boop, 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 boop. Well, by the end of the second or third day, we had painfully progressed down to roughly the letter M. We were now down about the middle of the alphabet, and the rest of the crowd that had started with us were already on the next floor. Forget it. They were gone. And our corporal was gone. Now, look, fellas. Look. Look. You're not listening right. It's all a matter of your head. Your head. You got to think code. You can't think letters. You can't write down. You got to think code. Look. Boo-boo-M. Boo-boo-M. Like that. You don't go Da, da, what is it? What is it? Write the first thing that comes down in your head, because you'll be right. It goes, boo, boo, M. Da, da, A. Da, da, A. Hear that? Da, da, A. Dit, E, E. Dit, E. Okay. All right, now let's start the tape. All right, Charlie, start the damn thing again. Boo, 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 boo. And the heads are bent over sweating. Well, about, I'd say roughly about a week and a half later, and now already you can see the big thermometer. It shows D1, which is the detachment that was just ahead of us. D1 is now up at 15 words a minute. They were the top one. C1 was down around 10 words a minute. A2 was up to about 9.5 words a minute. Guess where D2 was? We were still at the starting line. We had not even progressed beyond the starting line. We're bending, and you never saw such acting. If you think Paul Newman is an actor, if you think Rod Steiger can act, you ought to see 38 GIs refusing to learn code. I mean, I never saw such great acting. I'll have Gasser, for example. Gasser has got the most complete, he was the picture of concentration. Bending, breaking his pencil. Up my pencil, twink, almost getting past me, help. And I could see poor old Weber over there sweating. I knew that Weber, let me tell you this. Do you know Don Weber had been a high-speed operator at the Presidio in San Francisco? He was famous for being able to take 45 words a minute without even so much as one hand on the typewriter, you know? He could take 60 words a minute without even, you know, messing around, changing the paper. He gets up and walks around. The code is coming in. That kind of guy. And you ought to have seen him. He was beautiful on the sea. That particular, he's going, boop, 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 boop. He kept confusing it with the letter Q. He kept saying Q, because Q goes, goo, goo, goo. Well, about 12 days after our little group had started, in came the major. And I'll never forget this. What a beautiful morning that was. We're all bent over our desks, Don, and we're still sweating over. All right, you guys, listen. What's the matter? You gotta listen right, the corporal is. You gotta listen. Is N. Is A. It's the opposite. Is A. That's N. All right, now try it again. Send them an N, will you, Charlie? Doot it. Ooh, that's an N, not an A. That is, you heard me say N. What is, well, the code guy comes in there, and he, all of a sudden, all earphones went off. And we see this enraged look. He'd been an old ex-Army first sergeant who had been made a captain the minute that the bombs fell at Pearl Harbor. That old Army ex-first sergeant is now in charge of the code school. And he has run into his first problem. And he is standing up there wearing his hat sideways. He's got that little silver leaf hanging down over one ear, you know. He's that kind of officer with the collars are always kind of rolled up, you know, and he's got a shirt that's a little bit sweaty. And he hollers, I'm Major Abramowitz. And I can teach code to a dog. I can teach it to a dog. Now, you guys that are goofing off, you're going to get in trouble with me, and nobody is ever going to say that Major Abramowitz never taught no detachment how to take code. You hear that? You hear that? All right, start them code machines. Boo-boo. 38 guys write down N. D. All right, you guys, you're not going to get smart with me. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to transfer every last one of you guys to radar. And you know how hard that is. Boy, are you guys going to sweat when you get in them radar classes. Try goofing off in that one. I can teach code to a dog.
In 1963, I was a wet behind the ears, maybe even wet inside the ears, editor of a college humor magazine. I was spending a summer in New York, and along with Joel Siegel, who now reviews movies for Good Morning America, and Terry Gilliam, who now makes movies for everybody, I got a chance to sit with and interview Gene Shepherd just before he would do one of his nightly broadcasts. This is some of what he told us.
Within the next 15 years, I suspect that our lives will be practically geared to show business. Geared to it. Have you noticed right today? Kennedy, his closest friends are showbiz people. This is the first time in the history of our country that the president's confidants have been actors. And nobody seems to think that there's anything wrong in that, because they know themselves that if they were big enough, they would hang around with Sinatra.
You know, I never talked to anyone about listening to him because I didn't have any friends who I thought would understand it. And it almost seemed like if I mentioned anyone, it would go away. You know, it was like a dream. You know, if I talked to anyone about this, it wouldn't be there anymore.
This could be the very day upon which I confess everything.
In the next hour, learning to drink, the March on Washington, and getting into the movies on Gene Shepherd, A Voice in the Night.
That's coming up next week right here on this station, the final hour of Gene Shepherd, A Voice in the Night, hosted by Harry Shearer of Le Show.
This program occurred because of the affection for and gratitude to Gene Shepherd felt by myself and my co-producer, Art Silverman. Thanks also to Manoli Wetherill, Larry Josephs, and Ron Delacreza, WGBH Boston, WPLN Nashville, WBEZ Chicago, Max Schmidt, WBAI-FM New York, Herb Squire, WQXR New York, Randall Shepherd, Irwin Zwilling, WOR New York, John Gambling III, Laney Anderson, Eugene Bergman, KCRW, and Sarah Spitz. Thanks for listening, and Excelsior.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.